From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today, actor Tim Roth. He has over 100 acting credits, including Quentin Tarantino's films Reservoir Dogs, The Hateful Eight, and Pulp Fiction.
1 minute they're having a Denver omelette, next minute someone's sticking a gun in their face.
Now he stars opposite Clive Owen in the new film The Song of Names, about childhood friends, one of whom mysteriously disappears. Roth will talk about getting his start in London's pub theater scene and his first on-screen role as a white supremacist skinhead in the 1982 TV movie Made in Britain.
There were questions asked about it in Parliament. There were swear word counts that were printed in the tabloids. It took me by surprise. I got chased by skinheads down, the road in London.
Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the first solo album from Southern rock and blues artist Marcus King. Our guest, actor Tim Roth, may be best known for his roles in Quentin Tarantino films, including Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, where his attempt to rob a diner led to a memorable confrontation with Samuel L. Jackson's character. Roth is British, and he's appeared in more than 100 movies and TV productions on both sides of the Atlantic. He's currently starring in the Amazon series 10 Star. And he stars in a new film directed by Francois Girard called The Song of Names. Roth plays Martin Simmons, an Englishman who grew up in the 1930s, the son of a music publisher. On the eve of World War II, the family took in a 9-year-old violin prodigy, a Jewish child from Poland, and nurtured his talent. But he worried about his family back in Poland, which was overrun by the Nazis. In the 1950s, Martin's father spends a fortune to arrange a coming-out concert for the violinist, by then 21, who mysteriously doesn't show for the concert and disappears. In this scene, decades later, Martin has tracked him down. The violinist is played by Clive Owen. They're in the front seat of a minivan, speaking for the first time in 35 years. Roth's character Martin speaks first.
You have no idea, do you? Why did you do it?
I'm not sure you'd understand. You know, when I abandoned the Holy One, it took him 4 years to find me. It's taken you 35. Not bad.
Yeah, but your God didn't punish you, but maybe I will.
Oh, so would he. In time. Blessed be his name.
My father put everything he had into you. You ungrateful bastard! Hebrew lessons, bar mitzvah, violin. He treated you like a favorite son for 12 years and then you just buggered off without a word. He thought you were dead, Dove. He lost everything that night. And 2 months later, he dies with your name on his lips.
And that's our guest, Tim Roth, in the new film, The Song of Names. Tim Roth, welcome to Fresh Air. Good to have you.
Thank you.
What appealed to you about this role, this project?
Well, originally when they brought it to me, it was about two Jewish families, and my character originally was Jewish. And so it had a quality of being a private conversation in a sense. And I talked to the producer and to the director, and just to give my instant sort of reaction to the script, and I thought that it might be interesting if one side of the equation was not Jewish, and so didn't understand that community, and it was a mystery to him. So when he started to explore that and unravel that, we could take the audience along, the audience that weren't of the Jewish religion, along with him on that kind of ride and that kind of that discovery, and they jumped on that. So I thought, well, these guys are excited and interesting, and the story was beautiful. It's just a love story in one respect. It's a love story between these two men, these two boys, then over three sort of sections of their life.
You know, this story is about beautiful music, but it's also very much about the Holocaust, because the solution to the mystery of this violinist's disappearance is connected to the Holocaust and the importance of remembering those who perished. and honoring them. In this case, with a remarkable piece of music. And, you know, it connects to something that I read about your own father. He changed the family name, didn't he, from Smith to Roth?
Yeah, he did. He was an American immigrant, came over to England and as a child. And then, I suppose, yeah, it has a similarity in that he, by the time he had a rough childhood, and by the time he got to 17 years old, the war happened. And so then he joined up, which you shouldn't have been able to, but they took anyone at that point. And he joined the Air Force underage and became a tail gunner in bombers, and then survived for the duration. Was pretty uneducated, but taught himself Italian. Was stationed at the end on VE Day. I know he was in Italy at the time, and that was, you could choose to stay there. And he taught himself to speak Italian. He was fluent. But he thought better go back and see his parents. But he'd seen, not that he would talk about it much, but he'd seen awful things. And so he chose, because of, you know, he didn't have a good relationship with his family, decided to change his name. And he took a Jewish name, I believe a Swiss name in origin. I'm not sure. Swiss Jewish? I'm not sure. I can't remember the exact origin of it. But yeah, because of what he saw in the war, he came out of that, took a Jewish name, and as a consequence, I get invited to a lot of functions, which is rather pleasing.
And you have to explain that you never had a bar mitzvah.
Yeah, but I usually wait until, you know, after the fact for that, because the food's really good.
But that was a conscious choice. I mean, he didn't convert to Judaism, but he wanted to honor the memory of those. Huh?
Yeah. And I he wouldn't, like I say, it's a. My father-in-law is the same, and he was in Korea, but he discusses the war very little, and so I had to glean what I could over the years of my childhood with my father. You got little snippets now and again, but very, very few. Right. Yeah, I think it was a deeply distressing time for him.
Yeah. Well, for your dad to survive many years in the Royal Air Force was kind of remarkable in and of itself, wasn't it?
And a tail gunner, which is not exactly known for survival.
You became well known in the U.S. when you appeared in Quentin Tarantino's film Reservoir Dogs in, I think, 1992.
Right.
And then you had an ongoing relationship with him in several other films. And I thought I'd play a clip from Pulp Fiction, which is maybe one of the better known appearances by you. I mean, this is the one that I think of when I think of Tim Roth. This is a scene where you're in a diner with your girlfriend, played by Amanda Plummer. You're criminals, you're a stick-up team. And in this conversation, you're talking about, you know, what kind of places to stick up, and you think, why not rob a place like this restaurant? And at the end of the scene, that's what happens. Let's listen.
Nobody ever robs restaurants. Why not? Bars, liquor stores, gas stations. You get your head blown off sticking at one of them. Restaurants, on the other hand, you catch with their pants down. They're not expecting to get robbed. Not as expecting, anyway.
I bet you could cut down on the hero factor in a place like this.
Correct. Same as banks, these places are insured. Manager, you don't give a he's just trying to get you out the door before you start plugging the diners. Waitresses, forget it. No way they're taking a bullet for the register. Busboy, getting paid $1.50 an hour. Really give a you're stealing from the owner? Customers sitting there with food in their mouths. They don't know what's going on. One minute they're having a Denver omelette, next minute someone's sticking a gun in their face. See, I got the idea. The last liquor store we stuck up, remember? Mm-hmm. All the customers kept coming in.
Yeah.
You got the idea, taking their wallets. Mm-hmm. Now that was a good idea.
Thank you.
Made more from the wallets than we did from the register.
Yes, we did.
A lot of people come to restaurants.
A lot of wallets.
Pretty smart, huh?
Pretty smart. I'm ready. Let's do it. Right now. Right here. Come on.
All right. Same as last time, remember? Your crowd control. I handle employees.
Mm-hmm. I love you, pumpkin.
I love you, honey bunny.
Everybody be cool! This is a robbery!
Crisp Tarantino dialogue, a kiss and a hold up.
Yeah, right?
That's Tim Roth from Pulp Fiction. Tell us about getting to know Tarantino and connecting with him originally.
Originally, my introduction to America had been through Robert Altman when I did Vincent and Theo with him, and then had to come over and do press here. So, you know, and I got an agent during that time, and then worked up in New York, went down to LA and was thinking, I've got to get out of here. I've got to go home to London. And then they made me stay. My agents made me stay and sit about for a bit. So I started reading scripts. And this one arrived. This one, you know, she plunked on my table in my flat. And
That's Reservoir Dogs, right?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Reservoir Dogs. So that happened. And then within 20 pages, I was reaching for the phone. So I've got to do this. I have to meet this guy. And then I went in and I notoriously didn't read for stuff because I'm not very good at it. And so he managed to persuade me through various sort of beers to do that late at my flat and after a long day. And you know, we read everything. We had the best time and he gave me the job. And that was the beginning of my relationship. Well, that's a shorthand version of what it was. And it was the beginning of my relationship. And it's extraordinary when you play that clip there from Pulp Fiction. The one thing that is remarkable about Quentin's dialogue is he has done all of your improvising for you. He's already jumped the gun on that. It arrives and it just falls out of you. Sometimes you have to ask him, you know, what his musical rhythm is for a particular sentence, and and he will read it out for you. He'll say it, and you go, "Oh, I get it." But a lot of the work that you to make things seem natural and also not natural, which is, you know, it's not realism necessarily, but you know, it's a mixture of a few different worlds. He's already done that work for you in his writing. He's an absolutely remarkable writer. So, you know, we ended up having quite a good relationship, me and Quentin, from Reservoir Dogs through to Pulp Fiction through to Hateful Eight.
You know, the interesting thing, you said that you didn't want to audition. You didn't want to read for the part because you don't do that well or didn't do
that
well.
No, I'm just crap at it.
How do you convince people to give you a role without doing that? I mean,
well, I figured you lose 50% of the jobs by not reading, and then, you know, 50% of the jobs you get. I don't know what balance was, my reasoning was, but I was so bad at it that I'd lost enough jobs in Britain by being really awful in auditions that I just, after I got enough films under my belt, I just said, well, if you want to see if I can act, or, you know, go and look at those films. If you don't like them, don't hire me. And so, you know, when I met with Quentin, he wanted me to read, and Harvey Keitel was there, and it was very, for the Reservoir Dogs thing, and it was very important to Harvey that I read, and I wouldn't do it. And then we went out to a diner, and we sat, and I still wouldn't do it. And then I took Quentin to this pub that I used to go to, close to where I was living at the time, little flat that I had, and we had a few beers, and we went to the 7-Eleven, we went back to my flat, and we read everything. But I think it's probably the last time I've ever done that.
You know, this role in Pulp Fiction that we just heard is the one that kind of put you on in the map in my head as an actor. And that's followed by this very memorable back and forth you have with Samuel L. Jackson.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting. When I heard you were in Reservoir Dogs, I said, really? What was Tim Roth in Reservoir Dogs? And I realized the difference was you were an American undercover cop in that film.
That's right, it's
a completely different persona. And I kind of just didn't recognize you as the same guy. And I wonder if that's ever been an issue for you, just in establishing kind of a public presence that, I mean, if you're good at this, people may not recognize you from one film to another.
That's why I like doing the grocery shopping. So it helps in that respect. I suppose what I did was without necessarily thinking it through, but thinking about it afterwards, when I first came to the States and actually got employed, which was extraordinary in itself. I did Jeff Stanislaw's movie, the character from the Bronx. Then I went and did an episode of Tales from the Crypt, Tales out of the Crypt,
right? Tales from the Crypt, yeah.
Which was hilarious. But then I did Reservoir Dogs, played an American. James Gray's movie Little Odessa I did, played an American. So kind of felt that it was a good idea, and I discussed it a little bit with Gary Oldman when he came over to State of Grace, that it would be good, because they wouldn't know who we were, it'd be good to play Americans, and then after, if you got a couple of shots at that, then let them discover that you were English.
Huh, yeah.
The public, or the press, that is. And so that's kind of what happened.
You didn't go to drama school, right? You weren't trained as an actor, really, right? How did you get into it?
Well, I went, which was common in my family. My dad could draw. My mother was a painter, but she became a teacher. She was a primary school teacher. My dad became a journalist, in fact. But in our family was drawing and painting. So I went to art college. I went to art school. But before I did that, before I was due to go there, a friend of mine at school, at high school, me and him became obsessed with Samuel Beckett. And we would just annoy people with our behavior. I don't know what that was. But there was as a result of that, me and this friend of mine went to audition for a school play. It backfired completely. We did it as a joke, and it backfired completely, and I got the part. And so I had to do an all-singing, all-dancing performance of Dracula. It was called Dracula Spectacular. It was far from spectacular. But I had to do it in front of all the school bullies, everyone's a critic kind of situation. But I loved it. There was this extraordinary woman who ran a drama department who I was not... You know, I met her just through that, this joke that backfired, and she took me in. And so I fell in love with it. And I started, even before I went to art school, I started auditioning for, little community theatres and pub theatres. And she showed me what auditioning was. She showed me how to find out about them. She sent me to these community theatres, and I just quietly fell in love with it. But I did go on to art school, but... At the about a year and a half in, they sat me down and said, "You're taking the piss, so you should go off and see if you can become an actor. In the meantime, we'll keep this place open for you, and you can come back if it doesn't work out." And it worked out.
You're taking a piss. That's a way of saying you're not putting yourself into this.
You're not investing in. I mean, you know, there's plenty of people out there who would die for a place at this. It was Camberwell Art School in London, South London. It's one of the best fine art schools you can get into, and I was wasting the space. There's plenty of other people who could have used it and needed to be there, but my eye was on something else. As soon as I became besotted with this bizarre job of acting, and as soon as I'd sort of dipped my toe in, you know.
Right, and I learned from reading about you that there was this phenomena of pubs that had little theaters upstairs.
Yeah.
We were doing a lot of that.
Yeah, I did a trilogy of plays in a pub theater, and that got me going, and then I would do these community theaters in London, and yeah. But the pub theater was interesting, and it's still, I think it still is quite the thing in London and around England. Yeah, pub theaters. Yeah.
All right. Then there's your first role in front of a camera. This is pretty remarkable. How did you get this part?
Well, I was doing what out-of-work actors do, or is one of those things that is available to out-of-work actors, or was at that point, which was selling advertising to people who couldn't afford it and didn't want it over the phone. So you would be sitting in these booths in this office, and you would just be given a list of... I was a, what do they call them now, where you got
call centers, right?
Yeah, it's such a scam. Anyway, so you had a script, and you would, when you got someone on the phone, you would try and persuade them to part with their money. You know, terrible thing. And so I was cycling back at night across London, and I got a flat tire on my bike, and I called into this little community theatre that I'd worked at. And they didn't have a tire repair kit, but they told me about this audition for this television film that was being made, which was called Made in Britain. And I went up for it, and three shots at it, I ended up getting it.
Yeah. And it was the lead role.
It was the lead role. So I went, a third callback that I got, I went early, about an hour early, to the offices. And I'd been, you know, twice there before, so I knew that it looked over this park. This little park's in Soho, so in London. So I went and they said, oh no, you're early, you're supposed to be here at 12. I said, oh, don't worry about it, I'll go and wait in the park across the road and then I'll come back in. And I knew that they'd be watching me through the window, so I went into character a bit and got stopped by the police. And then a mate of mine who was a punk at the time came through. We got into a bit of trouble, and then an hour later I went in for the audition and got the job. But my real audition was in the park.
Wow.
Was them watching, and they told me that at the end of shooting. Yeah.
Right, and your character was a teenage skinhead, so
it was a Nazi skinhead, yeah, right. in the school system and then into the juvenile prison system, yeah.
Tim Roth stars in the new film, The Song of Names. After a break, he'll talk about the one film he directed, which deals with incest, and about drawing on his own family experience in shaping the story. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the first solo album from Southern rock and blues artist Marcus King. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle. Smile from my face, losing control, yeah, I'm all over the place. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right, here I am, stuck in the middle with you. When you started out with nothing and you pounded, you're a selfish man. And your fans, they all come calling, slap you on the back and say,
Support for this podcast and the following message come from E-Trade. Investing your money shouldn't require moving mountains, no matter how much or how little experience you have. E-Trade makes investing simpler. And for a limited time, get $100 when you open a new account with just $5,000. It's all about helping your money work hard for you. For more information, visit etrade.com/learnmore. E-Trade Securities, LLC. Member SIPC.
We're speaking with British actor Tim Roth, who's appeared in more than 100 TV shows and films, including Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and The Hateful Eight. He stars in a new film directed by François Gérard called The Song of Names. When we left off, we were talking about his first on-camera role, playing a Nazi skinhead in the 1982 TV movie Made in Britain. I want to play a clip from this. This is, as we said, you're kind of a Nazi skinhead. You have a small swastika tattooed on your forehead, kind of between your eyes. And this is a scene where you've been arrested for stealing and committing various acts of violence and vandalism. Mm. And you're with a couple of youth counselors who are trying to get you to change your thinking.
Oh, I know. I remember that scene.
Right, right. So one of the counselors speaks first.
Okay. You can walk out of this room now.
Why too?
But you must behave responsibly.
Grow up.
No more violence, right? And you start using some of the intelligence you're supposed to have.
That's right. Bollocks. Piss off, I hate you. Pair of you, I hate you.
I don't really know you, Trevor. You don't know me, so how can you hate me?
For putting me in here.
You put yourself in here.
Trevor, look, sorry. You were kicking doors down, breaking the place up.
I'm British!
So?
Well, do you know what that means, do you?
I think so, yes.
You're proud to be British, aren't you?
What do you mean, Trevor?
Don't you know I'm proud?
I don't really think about it like that, Trevor.
That's because you spend too much time locked up in here with all these...
Oh, I see. British Bulldog, 1, 2, 3.
I'm more British than you are. You hate the blacks as much as I do, and you don't admit it. You hate the blacks more than I do because they frighten you. That's why you lock them up.
Watch your tongue.
You lock up anything that frightens you.
The only thing that frightens me, Trevor, are the people who put sick ideas like that into children's heads.
Trevor, you're not in prison. This is not a prison.
In here, it's just the same as school. Do what we tell you. Think what we tell you. Say what we tell you. I hate you for putting me in here. You swallow your own bollocks, you expect me to swallow it too. Blacks in here is thick as with no brains. You know it. Admit it.
And that is our guest, Tim Roth, as a skinhead in Made in Britain, 1982. What do you think of the acting now that you hear it after all this time?
It's an odd. I think there were some jumps in there with the with the speech, but the I found it to be when I it was the first time I'd ever seen myself on camera, and it was, there were questions asked about it in Parliament. There was there were, you know, swear word counts that were printed in the tabloids. It was all a bit. It took me by surprise. I got chased by skinheads down, you know, the road in London.
Wow! So this was well known and controversial.
Yeah, I was on at that point. I believe I was Oi Man of the Year of the skinhead mob, and I was on the cover of Gay News at the same time when that came out, which was quite extraordinary. But it was truly shocking to me, but also it was a door that opened. And Alan Clark was a remarkable director. He did a film called Scum about the juvenile prison system with Ray Winstone and Phil Daniels. He nurtured young talent, and he helped me get onto the next job I did with Mike Lee, which came directly after that. But what do I think of it? It makes me cringe, but it was the beginning of what was interesting about that sequence. If you see the whole thing, is that it was the beginning of Steadicam, and that was one of the early times that it was used. This extraordinary cinematographer, Chris Menges, was the operator, and it was a new piece of equipment, hardly ever used. But it meant that they could light in 360 degrees, and we could perform that entire sequence, which is, I think, about 20 minutes long, almost in one, constantly.
Right.
And I thought that's how films were made. I didn't realize until I went on to the next job that things are normally broken down pieces, and mm-hmm. I couldn't understand why it was taking so long.
You know, and it's amazing that you're an inexperienced actor and you are in every scene, I think. You just have tons and tons of lines. Were you intimidated by it, or just like too naive to even know?
No, I was, we went into rehearsal. We rehearsed everything in great detail. But the director had such a way about him, sadly gone, died quite young. But he had such a way about him. I felt no nerves at all. I was just by the time we finished, we had a couple of weeks of rehearsal, I think I was desperate to jump into it, and to see what it felt like.
Did you base the character on people you knew, or?
Yeah, there was one guy who busted me on it actually afterwards. It was a guy that had a, during the punk time, I was working in a supermarket. I was a place called Tesco's in England, filling shelves and stuff. And he was one of the guys that was working with me. And he was a punk, and I was a punk. And and so we became kind of friends. But he had a taste for violence. And he was incredibly smart, which Trevor, the character that I play in Made in Britain, is as well. But he had that gleam in his eye, and we got into all kinds of trouble. We got arrested. We got running battles and all kinds of things. And so there was an element of him that I brought to it. Although he wasn't a skinhead, we used to get beaten to crap by skinheads. But yeah, there was a little bit of him in it. And he tapped me on the shoulder years later in a club in London and said, "That was me, wasn't it?" And
I said, "Wow,
yeah, kind of was." Yeah.
What did you get arrested for?
Violence. I was with this guy, and we were chased, a group of punks, we were chased by a group of skinheads. I think it was a group of skinheads, yeah, it usually was. And a fight ensued, and I wasn't a great fighter at all. I was just getting thumped. And we got arrested by some officers. It was in by Trafalgar Square, and we spent the night in the cells there. And that was when... that and a couple of other incidents where I thought, it's time to get out of this. So I grew my hair and got out of there.
Well, I mean, I guess in part because this film was such a phenomenon and got such attention. I mean, you then had several years where you worked with some terrific British actors, John Hurt, Terence Stamp, Gary Oldman, and great directors like Stephen Frears and Mike Leigh.
Yeah.
Must have been like going to school.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of Made in Britain, the director asked me, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I want to be an actor." And he said, in what way anyway, but I'd said I've heard about this director Mike Lee, and you know, and he said he's auditioning. So he picked up the phone, we were on set, we were on in the last week of filming, and he got in touch with him, and I went in and met with Mike, and then ended up doing his film. It actually, a couple of things came from Made in Britain. That happened, a film called Meantime with Mike, which is an improvised film. It's a very interesting way of working. And then the film with John Hurt and Terence Stamp, with Stephen Frears directing, was supposed to be Joe Strummer from The Clash playing my role. But he was having trouble with the band of some kind, so he said, get that skinhead in. And that's how I ended up getting that job. So I had one, two, three, you know, great directors, and that was, for me, that was college. You know, I working with those three was that kind of, that was my getting, you know, it was like getting your degree, really.
We're speaking with Tim Roth. He stars in the new film, The Song of Names. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Fresh Air.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Imperative Entertainment, presenting The Baron of Botox, a new podcast series from the team behind Broken Hearts. The Baron of Botox is about late dermatologist to the stars Frederick Brandt, who helped usher in the multi-billion dollar Botox industry. When Brandt killed himself in 2015, journalist and veteran magazine editor Justine Harmon began to obsess over one question: what is the price of beauty? Check out the trailer for The Baron of Botox and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
NPR's Code Switch is a podcast about race in America that's about all of us. Our histories, how we're represented, the ways we've worked together and worked against each other. You'll learn, you might get mad, you'll definitely laugh, but don't take my word for it. Just listen to NPR's Code Switch.
This is Fresh Air, and we're speaking with actor Tim Roth. He stars in the new film, The Song of Names. You directed one film, The War Zone, which is based on a novel by Alexander Stewart. He also wrote the screenplay. A terrific cast here, Ray Winston, Tilda Swinton, and two great younger actors. It's about a family in which the boy, the family, discovers that the father is sexually abusing his daughter. Mm-hmm. It's very powerful. I know that you revealed in past interviews that you had been abused by your paternal grandfather when you were a kid. I don't know how much you want to say about this, but I'm wondering, was that one of the things that drew you to this book and this project?
No, I was looking for anything but that. And then this extraordinary, there was this producer, Sarah Radcliffe. They had worked on this. They'd been trying to get this book done as a film for quite some time. I'd said to my agent, okay, I'm going to direct, you know, because so many directors had said to me, just go off and do it, stay out of my business. So okay. So I was looking, so officially looking. It was after Rob Roy, and I had a bit of money in the bank. So I went, okay. And this was the first thing that came at me, and it was given to me by the producer's assistant at the time, or co-producer at the time, Dixie Linder, who I've worked with since as a producer, and she's still a friend of mine. But this book landed, and it was the absolute last thing that I wanted to turn into a film. And then I read it, and I realized that the person who had written the book, Alexander Stewart, had, while he had got quite a lot of it right, I could tell he it wasn't his subject necessarily. He'd written it for other reasons, and so I met with him, and he told me his son unfortunately had passed away, and he wanted to write something about the fragility of childhood, and so that was the way that he chose to do it. And so I said, well, this is my subject, I've got this, so I can help you out and fix this up for you in where it needs to be.
So what did he not get right that you knew from your experience?
Well, you know, I knew it from you know, looking outwards, and there were certain elements of it that he just didn't know. It wasn't in his bailiwick, if you can say that.
But can you share what you mean by these elements? I don't know how far I want to push you on this, but this
he just didn't, you know, he was making guesses at what it felt like to be, you know, living in an abusive relationship, in an abusive household, and all of that was well and good, and he did a very good job on it. But I said, well, let me give you the insider's perspective. You know, it's weird because I didn't know that my father had been abused until way, way late. But I was in my mid 20s at the time when he first brought that subject up, and that. What that did was let me talk about it, you know. It gave me a voice, which mm-hmm. was, you know, an incredible thing. But it's you know, it wasn't a film that I was looking to make, but I ended up making it anyway. And I enjoyed the directing process.
Right. You know, and the stuff that you brought to us, was it dialogue? Was it a feeling?
I think it was stripping it away, to be honest.
Uh-huh.
One of the first things that we talked about, me and him, was the book is set in the summertime in a tourist-heavy part of the world, and there were a lot of characters and a lot of lots of friends about, lots of distractions, and so we flipped it. I think it was his idea, but it was one that I kind of was very keen to do, which was we flipped it, set it in the winter with no one else around. I think there are nine actors involved in that
right.
film.
But the family's pretty Martin. Isolated.
And yeah, but in the book that wasn't the case.
Right. So that that loneliness amidst the pain.
Yeah. 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 Mm. So you could focus on it.
You know, I've read that you don't like to watch your work. I mean, like, even a movie when you filmed it, if there's a premiere, you just as soon hang out in the lobby. Is this true?
Yeah, I tend to slide. I started doing that, say, about 10, 15 years ago. I start to just go, you know what? It's not, once I'm done with it, in a certain sense, it's not for me anymore. And I just decided I'm not a critic.
Well, that's what strikes me about it is that, I mean, when you're on the set, I mean, you're not seeing the movie, right? You're seeing what's happening on the set. You're experiencing it. And then
when I worked with Altman, at the end of every, say, at the end of every filming week, he'd show the dailies, you know, what we'd shot during the week or the week before to the crew, and it became a party, and it was a thing that we did. And when I did The War Zone, I adopted that, and I would show the crew or anyone who wanted to come, they could come and sit and have a beer, and we actually built a screening room above a pub, so there you go, that kind of thing. But I never watch rushes as an actor, and I never watch a monitor on set or any of that stuff. I don't do any of that. I remember having this conversation with Quentin when we were doing Reservoir Dogs, and I don't watch stuff. I find it distracts, and I think sometimes for me, just on a personal level, you know, I start overthinking stuff. I like to just work from the gut. But Steve Buscemi, for example, uses watching dailies, checking his performance and then tweaking it, and that's how he works. That's how he structures a performance. And Quentin was pretty much rigid. I don't want anyone seeing it. You know, this is how I want to work. And I remember arguing for Steve's side of it, even though it wasn't my side of it, in a sense. You know, I say, well, that's how he works, though. So maybe you could do a private thing for him. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, but I tend not to watch now. I think I've seen enough. My opinion of it is not, in a sense, relevant. It's over to you guys. It's over to the audience.
Someone asked you, in something that I read, if you plan to do a lot of more theater, and you said that you have stage fright.
I have a really bad stage
really?
Fright.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Did you have stage fright way back when you
While
were doing stuff
yeah,
in pubs?
Yeah. 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 And I did a couple of big theaters. I did a adaptation of Metamorphosis that Berkoff had done, which we did in virtually the West End, I suppose, a big house. I did a Sam Shepard play up in New York. That was the last time I did it. At the Actors Studio, we did it there. I walk miles and miles backstage before I can get out on stage.
And it
terrifies me.
And you have it every night? It doesn't matter if it's the first week or the third week?
No, I mean, it does get a little less, but yeah, it's... I, and it's a shame because I really wish I could do it. I really would. I'd like that. I've been offered a lot of plays, you know, and over the years, still get offered them. But it does scare me. But maybe one day I'll get tempted back.
You know, I mean, look at your, you've done like 80 films and movies or whatever the number is. It, I don't know, does this make sense to you that you still feel?
I don't know, they still, I mean, I think you're, you know, in Britain, the, I don't know what you call, yeah, British people. right now, it's a bit tricky. But there was you were driven by a fear of unemployment. That was your main drive, and certainly as actors, you're mostly unemployed, or you know you should be. It seems to be the common occurrence. I just got employed, and then when I came to America, they employed me even more, and so I stuck about. But that's you know, that's the sort of driving force, really. And also, I mean, I still don't really consider it a proper job, you know.
Acting, you mean?
Yeah.
you're getting paid to pretend?
Yes. I mean, what a gig, really. I mean, it's an extraordinary privilege.
Well, Tim Roth, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tim Roth stars in the new film, The Song of Names. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the first solo album from Southern rock and blues artist Marcus King. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, inviting you to check out our new online archive, collecting 40 years of Fresh Air interviews and reviews. You can hear my interviews with people like David Bowie, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, John Updike, Toni Morrison. Search for names you're interested in. Make a playlist for yourself or friends at freshairarchive.org. That's freshairarchive.org.
Marcus King is a 23-year-old from Greenville, South Carolina, who until now was best known for the Southern rock and blues he made with the Marcus King Band. Now he's released his first solo album called El Dorado. It represents a different direction in King's career. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review of how soulful Marcus King's new music can be.
Wildflowers and wine, old scratchy record plays in the background of our lives. We're still here dancing after all this time. Wildflowers and wine.
Marcus King sings in that new song about the quote-unquote old scratchy records he listens to. And you get the feeling that in preparing to make his new album El Dorado, King might have dusted off his Otis Redding and Solomon Burke records to study. As a guitarist who's arrived at his early 20s with a solid reputation as a blues prodigy, he's already restless for new areas of exploration. Perhaps seeking to make sure he doesn't alienate his old fans, however, he took care to make the second song on this new album a blues barn burner.
I was just a young and bouncing on my mama's knee. She said there's only one thing to set your soul free. Wasn't no easy street where I come from. There wasn't no sleep until the work was done. Preaching by the fires of hell. If you want a drink of water, got to go to the well. The cornerstone church trying to curse my soul. But the good Lord give me that rock and roll.
That song called The Well is typical of what Marcus King has done on the previous albums, but it's more the exception than the rule on El Dorado. What changed? Well, King moved to Nashville and struck up a friendship with Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys. The two started writing songs together, songs that sent King in a different direction toward a more rhythm and blues-based area. and Auerbach offered to produce a King solo album. It's yielded such lovely surprises as this soul ballad called Break. With its falsetto vocal and the way the keyboards become more important than the guitar, Break is the clearest representation of Marcus King's new sound. King's road band has been, at least momentarily, sidelined here. The musicians Dan Auerbach assembled for the album are a collection of veteran session players, like keyboard player Bobby Wood and drummer Gene Chrisman, who have played on hits for artists ranging from Elvis Presley to Wilson Pickett to Willie Nelson. Their subtlety shines through on this gospel-inflected ballad, Beautiful Stranger.
Beautiful stranger, come here quite often. I don't know your name, but I know what you
So now the question is, which is the real Marcus King, Southern blues rocker or blue-eyed soul balladeer? Some combination of both? This feels like a turning point for him. But with Dan Auerbach co-writing every song on El Dorado, it's impossible to tell what King will do the next time he strikes out on his own. Whatever happens down the road, though, this album is a real beauty.
Rock critic Ken Tucker reviewed El Dorado, the new solo album from Marcus King. On tomorrow's show, did President Trump really call his top military commanders a bunch of dopes and babies? We'll hear from two Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters from The Washington Post, Philip Rucker and Carol Lenig, who did more than 200 interviews for their inside account of the Trump administration called A Very Stable Genius. I hope you can join us. And this final note, the genealogical family history of Terry Gross, as well as those of Mark Maron and Jeff Goldblum, will be explored on tonight's edition of the PBS series Finding Your Roots, hosted by Henry Louis Gates. If impeachment hearings preempt tonight's episode on your local PBS station, you'll still be able to watch it online at pbs.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Thea Challoner, Mooj Zaidi, and Seth Kelly. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Sweet Mariona, long as I've known you, you were the apple of my eye, all the stars in my sky, I adore you. Mariona, from California to the heavens above, I can still feel your love growing stronger. Over the rainbow, I know that you know. Whenever you cross my mind, the sun's gonna shine. Sweet.